On September the 12th, 2001, the day after the terrorist attacks on New York and Washington, President George Bush spoke with his counter-terrorism czar, Richard Clark.
Look, I know you have a lot to do and all, but I want you, as soon as you can, to go back over everything. Everything. See if Saddam did this. See if he's linked in any way.
Clark was incredulous.
But, Mr. President, Al-Qaeda did this.
He had been hammering on for years about the threat from Al-Qaeda.
I know. But see if Saddam was involved. Just look.
You don't argue with the commander-in-chief. So Clark nodded.
Absolutely. We will look again. But you know, we have looked several times for state sponsorship of Al-Qaeda and not found any real linkages to Iraq. Now, Iran plays a little, as does Pakistan and Saudi Arabia and Yemen.
Look into Iraq. Saddam.
Bush looked irritated and moved on. In Clark's personal view, this was totally wrong-headed.
Having been attacked by Al-Qaeda, for us now to go bombing Iraq in response would be like invading Mexico after the Japanese attacked us at Pearl Harbor.
But Iraq did become the administration's prime target after 9/11. This was a war born of obsession and sold by deception, reflecting the hubris of men who believed they'd won the Cold War and could do anything. But at a deeper level, it was rooted in the ideology of America itself as the empire of liberty. Against all expectations after the Gulf War of 1991, Saddam Hussein had clung on to power in Iraq. In Washington, this was deeply worrying. Saddam had used chemical weapons on Iran and on his own people. There was also evidence that he was working to develop nuclear weapons. But the efforts of the UN weapons inspectors to close down these programs got nowhere, as the Iraqis played cat and mouse. So in December 1998, America and Britain bombed Iraqi military installations. Iraq was therefore already a problem by the time Bush entered the White House in January 2001, but it was not a major item on his agenda. What put it there were the neocons and the impact of 9/11. The neoconservatives were a disparate group, but they shared a black-and-white worldview that starkly pitted good against evil, with the US leading the forces of good. They believed that military power was what mattered in the world and argued that America should act decisively without worrying about the United Nations, derided as weak and corrupt, or even historic allies such as Western Europe. Passionately for Israel and against militant Islam, the neocons saw the Middle East as America's prime battleground, with the Iraqi regime as enemy number one. In 1998, leading neocons signed an open letter to President Bill Clinton.
The only acceptable strategy is one that eliminates the possibility that Iraq will be able to use or threaten to use weapons of mass destruction. In the near term, this means a willingness to undertake military action, as diplomacy is clearly failing. In the long term, it means removing Saddam Hussein and his regime from power. That now needs to become the aim of American foreign policy.
When George W. Bush became president, most of the senior foreign policy jobs went to leading neocon intellectuals or those who shared their priorities. The new Secretary of Defense was Donald Rumsfeld, a bureaucratic bruiser who'd also held the post under President Gerald Ford in the 70s, making him both the youngest and the oldest defense secretary in U.S. history. In November 2001, the president asked Rumsfeld to update U.S. planning for a possible war against Iraq. The neocons were now in full cry, seeking to use the war on terror to deal once and for all with Saddam. What made their argument seem persuasive within the administration was what happened on 9/11. If terrorists could achieve that kind of damage using aircraft, what might they do with weapons of mass destruction? And which was the rogue state most likely to have such weapons? Answer, Iraq, under its brutal dictator. The logic was hardly watertight, but this was an administration gripped by nightmares. In his State of the Union message in January 2002, the president identified North Korea, Iran, and Iraq as repressive and dangerous.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world. America will do what is necessary to ensure our nation's security. The United States of America will not permit the world's most dangerous regimes to threaten us with the world's most destructive weapons.
Axis of evil was the phrase that captured the headlines. The word axis evoked Hitler and his allies in World War II. Evil demonized Iraq, Iran, and North Korea as almost agents of the devil. And by echoing Reagan's warning in 1983 about the evil empire, Bush was suggesting that the war on terror was the lineal descendant of the Cold War. Of the three axis of evil states, Iraq was the priority, and the momentum for war was building inexorably in Washington. The main resistance against it came from Colin Powell and the State Department. Although increasingly marginalised, stuck in the refrigerator, as he joked ruefully, Powell tried to argue the case against war. On August 5, 2002, he had a rare chance to reel off his concerns to Bush.
You are going to be the proud owner of 25 million people. You will own all their hopes, aspirations, and problems.
And he warned against the neocons' go-it-alone mentality.
It's nice to say we can do it unilaterally, except you can't. If you think it's just a matter of picking up the phone and blowing a whistle and it goes, no. You need allies.
Powell was largely responsible for persuading the president to work with the UN, anathema to the neocons, in the hope that this could force Saddam to abandon his weapons program or at least lay the basis for an international coalition if it came to war. Here was a fundamental clash between the traditional US policy since World War II of working with allies and the neocons' post-Cold War vision of unilateral power plays. But although Powell slowed the rush to war, he could not stop it. To help build the administration's case, the intelligence agencies were now being leaned on to massage the fragmentary and ambiguous evidence about Saddam's weapons programs into a clear-cut case for war. Vice President Dick Cheney told American veterans in August 2002,
"Simply stated, there is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction. There is no doubt he is amassing them to use against our friends, against our allies, and against us. And there is no doubt that his aggressive regional ambitions will lead him into future confrontations with his neighbors."
Cheney also dismissed concerns that the U.S. was going to get bogged down in Iraq, like it had in Vietnam. Bullishly, he told one skeptical Republican congressman,
"Now we have great information. They're going to welcome us. It'll be like the American army going through the streets of Paris in 1944. They're sitting there ready to form a new government. The people will be so happy with their freedoms that we'll probably back ourselves out of there within a month or so."
What followed is now a familiar story. Finally losing patience with the UN, the US, plus token but important British military support, invaded Iraq in March 2003.
Thank you, Mr. Bush! Thank you, Mr. Bush!
The capital, Baghdad, fell in less than 3 weeks, and on May the 1st, President Bush flew dramatically onto the deck of the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln. He thanked the U.S. Armed Forces.
"Because of you, our nation is more secure. Because of you, the tyrant has fallen, and Iraq is free."
Behind the president was a large banner proudly proclaiming "Mission accomplished." Intended as a PR coup, this speech proved one of the biggest gaffes of the Bush presidency. Up to that date, 139 Americans had died in Iraq. 3 years later, the US death toll passed the 3,000 killed on 9/11, and the figure was still rising. Because of Rumsfeld's neglect of post-war planning, the demise of Saddam's regime created a huge power vacuum, which was filled by rival insurgent groups whom the US could not control. And without police and security services, the country descended into anarchy. As images of looting filled the TV screens, Rumsfeld said defensively,
"Stuff happens. It's untidy, and freedom's untidy, and free people are free to make mistakes and commit crimes and do bad things. They're also free to live their lives and do wonderful things, and that's what's going to happen here."
Bush stuck to his mantra, proclaimed on the deck of the Abraham Lincoln, that once the tyrant had fallen, the people would be free. This, after all, was essentially the argument of the Declaration of Independence, and Bush was a true believer in the American creed. Looking back at the end of the Cold War and the democratization of the old Soviet bloc, he declared,
"It is no accident that the rise of so many democracies took place in a time when the world's most influential nation was itself a democracy. Liberty is both the plan of heaven for humanity and the best hope of progress here on earth."
Bush remained unrepentant about Iraq, despite the long and bloody war and the fact that none of the fabled weapons of mass destruction were ever found. The shambles didn't cost him re-election, but his poll ratings dropped steadily, and from early in his second term he became a lame duck. A surge of troops in 2007 and a reduction in street violence allowed the administration to start withdrawing some US soldiers. The focus now shifted to finding a plausible exit strategy to wind down a war that, by the end of Bush's presidency, had cost 4,150 American lives and over $800 billion. On the Iraqi side, the lowest credible estimate of the dead was 100,000, with the real total probably far higher. And the prospects for a stable, unified and democratic country were remote. So even if liberty is the plan of heaven for humanity, turning that plan into reality did not prove as simple as Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld and the neoconservative visionaries had suggested. Freedom was indeed untidy. Unfortunately, stuff does happen. For many Americans, the neocons had turned out to be con men, and Bush's successor was left to clean up the mess.